Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Sentimental Garbage, the podcast where we talk about the chick lit that made us who we are. My name is Karen O'Donoghue and I'm an author, a journalist and a precious jewel trapped in Dashin's stomach. Joining me is author, biographer and dispossessed Russian royalty, Laura Woods. Today we're talking about Eva Ibbotson's A Countess Below Stairs.
Laura. Yes.
This book, tell me why it's so special.
Everything about it is so special. It's just really beautiful, I think. It's the sort of book that you can luxuriate in. It's such a comfort read. It's like a kind of... It's got such a fairy tale quality yeah. about it, I think. And it's so escapist. And I just love it. I think it's a beautiful... I think this book is a jewel, definitely. It's really
in a Dashin stomach?
Yes, exactly. Or that we refuse to operate on.
What I loved about this book, apart from everything you just said, the fairy tale, the history, the sumptuousness yeah. of it, is that it's one of those few books that manages to convey a really vast world in a very small amount of pages.
Yeah, she's... I just think she's amazing at that. And I think one of the things that I thought when I was rereading it this time was about how... I'm always struck by how clever she is as a writer, but I think her strength is in the way she writes her characters, because there are so many characters in this book,
yeah.
like hundreds and hundreds of characters. And each one of them... even if they don't take up very much space on the page, is so yeah. fully realised, and you completely know who that person is, it's not just that you know who they are, you care about them so instantly as well, which she's so good at.
And there were so many bits where I was, because this is my first Eva Ibbotson, I'd never heard of her before this juncture, for all my sins, and I kept all the characters, it's like, oh, I hope there's a novel about them, I hope she has another extended universe, because
yes.
they have that feeling, they feel like they've popped in from their own fully furnished universe,
yes, that's
just
it.
To say hi. I'm going to do a quick plot summary to get everyone up to date, although I have to say, when I tweeted the reading list for this season, this was the one where people were like, oh my god, take everything, take my money. So, after the Russian Revolution, Countess Anna Grudzinski flees to England with her governess in an attempt to make a new life for herself and her family. She winds up working as a maid for the Westerholm family, a once great English country household that has been decimated by the First World War. Anna throws herself into her work and wins the whole household over until Rupert, the new Earl of Westerholm, returns home from war with his new wife Muriel, or his new fiance, I should say, a woman who considers eugenics a hobby.
Yes. Boo!
Muriel! As Anna and Rupert fall in love, the wedding hurtles closer and Muriel's true character is revealed. I don't know where to start. I guess the start, but I think I've become more British just by reading that. Like, I've been in England for 10 years and now I feel like I've been here for 30
yes.
years just by saying the new Earl
the
of Westerholm.
Yes. Yeah, and I love the idea of that Anna is this secret countess in a world that's kind of couched in the sort of British aristocracy anyway.
Yes.
So it's
so fascinating, because when I read the back of the book, and it's very like, oh, when a Russian countess, as I just said, when a Russian countess falls down on her luck, blah blah, and then you assume it's going to be one of those books a bit like Sophie Kinsella's The Undomestic Goddess, where
yeah.
it's her hiding her status.
Yes.
But actually, because of the historical context of the novel, because it's post-World War I, because so many people have either slid down so far in the world or gone up so far in the world, and we see a lot of that in this book, people have lost huge swathes of their families. The whole staff of this house has been wiped out. And actually, people know from the beginning, not that she's a countess, but that she's this obviously very well brought up
yeah,
girl.
Absolutely.
And they're just kind of shrugging. They're like, you know what? The war did things to us all.
Yeah. And I love how also at the beginning of the book, there's when she turns up to work everyone's initial response to her is one of complete dismay, like, oh, here's this proper lady, and yeah. she's not, you know, we understand why she's here, but she's not going to be able to do it. And then part of Anna's charm is that she just hurls herself into yeah. anything in such a way that she's determined to be successful at it. And I really love that. I really love how also she frames her kind of domestic role as a sort of blow for women everywhere, as this kind of, if you know, if my cousin can go off and work, and if my brother can go off and work
and drive a taxi,
then I can go off and work, and no one's going to stop me from helping to provide for my family. And so, yeah, I think it's really lovely when she arrives in that way and kind of kicks back against everyone's expectations of her.
And there's this, it's interesting because I mean, the pretext is so sad. It's a very sad thing of, like, you're introduced and there's this kind of 15 page prologue where it just gives you this this young adult's life up until that point. And she's born into this wonderful Russian family in the height of Imperial Russia. And she's like, you know, minks everywhere, jewels yes. everywhere. It's like Chicago. then it's sort of, there's this beautiful, beautiful bit. I'm actually going to read from it. It's on page 12. And where you've spent pages and pages just being like, and for her third birthday, she got a tiny crystal otter.
Yeah, yes. The Fabergé just rolling in.
It's so Fabergé, and it's so beautiful, and you're getting all this opulence. And then suddenly it just says on page 12, "And then the Archduke, with the face of an ill-tempered bullfrog, and the charming wife who had so dearly and unaccountably loved him, were assassinated at Sarajevo. To the Russians, accustomed to losing czars and grand dukes time and time again in this way, it seemed just another in an endless succession of political murders. But this time, the glittering toy that was the talk of war slipped from the hands of politicians, and a world ended." And what I love about that, apart from just the sort of kind of Mitford-y kind of like, oh, and the ugly Duke with the lovely wife, blah, 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 gossip.
Yeah, really chatty.
I love how it's, and it kind of sets up the pretext for the whole book, which is, and a world ended, yes. not the world ended, a world. And yeah. it's like this beautiful thing of this lovely young woman who, like, has had the best of everything in life to an obscene extent. And that part of her life ends, and it's not, it is a tragedy. Her father dies, it's awful, but it's not like everything she does after that is awful. Like, she makes friends, she moves on. Yeah. It's a book about coping with changed circumstances.
Yeah, absolutely. And the way, and again, when we were saying about how Eva does this amazing thing of doing so much with so little, like, you were just saying, you know, that's page 12 of the novel. You have this sort of 15-page section at the beginning, which is like heaven. It's just so gorgeous to read, and it's this really indulgent moment of being in that kind of high luxury, magical fairy tale idea, dream of what Russia would have been then. And then she kind of does such a good job of breaking your heart when she talks about, because in such a short amount of time you already know that Anna's relationship with her father is so special, and then you know, he dies right at the beginning of the book, and that's so sad. But she also, like you say, she sets it up so that what comes afterwards, if you were kind of outlining it, could be such a miserable story. It could be this really terrible, trying story, but because Anna is so resilient and so joyful, and I think that's a really big thing in this book. She is so full of joy that it literally, you know, lights her up, and everyone talks about that the whole way through the book. She it's just about, like you said, finding joy in different places, and she kind of even though the story goes to some dark places, there's still the lightness of touch there and the pleasure in things.
Yeah.
That's really special, I think.
And what's nice is there's a slight hint of, like, Marie Antoinette sort of playing at being a milkmaid thing, in that she has this book that she's found.
Yeah,
sort of like
I love it.
The guide
Sarah
to
Strickland.
Selena Strickland.
Yeah.
Who she's like, oh, she finds a 600-page tombstone on, like, Victorian housekeeping.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, find my carbonate of this to do this. And she just quotes it endlessly throughout the book, and she's kind of has this sort of fantasy of being a kind of a Dickensian scullery maid.
Absolutely. And because she has this kind of, in the beginning of that book, you find out she has this history of throwing herself so wholeheartedly into things. And part of that is, you know, like she has that moment where she decides to dress in rags and wear wooden shoes that are supposed to be fashioned by Tolstoy or something, and she's kind of living this. She and her family sort of look on her with indulgence the way she chucks herself into these things. And there's that scene later on where she's at the party and her brother turns up and she has to suddenly not be a maid, but her hands are bleeding. And when someone says, oh, but you know, that's just Anna, she was dipping her hands in the soda so that it would be a convincing performance.
Yeah,
no one questions that, because it's so in keeping with how she behaves.
Just committed all the time. Never not committed.
Yeah, just whatever she's doing, she's 100% into it, isn't she? And that's part of the pleasure of reading about her character, I think.
Yeah. I don't know anything about Eve Ibbotson. And honestly, she is the perfect sentimental garbage author to cover, because there's not that much out there about her. But I understand you're working on a biography.
Yeah, I am. Yes. It's really early stages, so I don't know as much about Eva Ibbotson as I will know about her. But the little bit that I know already is so interesting, and it's so easy to see how much of her life informs the way that she writes. And with this book, I think, I guess what I found particularly striking about it was she was born in Germany and moved to Vienna while she was still a baby. And then her parents divorced, she was living with her grandparents, and in the 30s, with the oncoming of the Second World War, she's kind of evacuated out of Vienna over to England. She comes over to Britain as a refugee. And her mother, Anna Gabena, who's at that time a very famous playwright, who's kind of a radical playwright whose work's being burned by Hitler. And she is living in London now with her second husband, who is a Russian. Who Eva had this amazing relationship with, Sasha, and he and they're living in this house in London, which is, from the sound of it, is like the Russian Club, with all these kind of big characters who have all kind of fled from the continent, who are living in not great circumstances, very reduced circumstances. And they're just these big characters, and you can see how there's so much of this book that she's taken from that experience. So even though this book is dealing with the kind of aftermath of the First World War, I think it's kind of fair to say that quite a lot of what's inspiring her is this kind of time around the Second World War when she was a child.
That's fascinating. And there's very important character in the book called Ollie, short for Olive.
Oh my gosh, the Honourable Ollie.
The Honourable, and honestly, I don't enjoy a plucky, winsome, disabled child in literature. I just don't.
It doesn't sound like it's going to be great,
no,
does it?
No, and she's like, oh, it's like, oh, the little cripple that everyone loves kind of thing. And those things always strike me as Tiny Tim-ish too much, and they're a bit heavy-handed. But this character, this child, is written so beautifully.
She is the character. I was just saying to you that when I was rereading this book for the 100th time on the train on the way in, I finished it, and I, even though I've read it so many times, there were tears at the end And it's when the Honourable Olive pops up and starts talking in her kind of mothering tone. And I just think she's such a brilliant character. But so much of...
But is that... But we could say, because there is a... So she is... preyed upon by the terrible Muriel. Terrible Muriel.
You're so terrible Muriel.
Which we'll get to in a minute. We could do the whole thing on Muriel, to be honest. But she's sort of saved by Anna from this terrible run-in she has with the terrible Muriel. And then she does go to the Russian club.
Yeah.
So you could almost see Eva Ibbotson going with her stepfather.
Yeah, absolutely. That idea of a child being there and looking around it as this kind of magical place that's full of these kind of weird, wonderful characters and
people drinking to her beauty and the stuffed corpse.
Oh my gosh, that's my favourite when they say that Olive's kind of been very hurt and she's feeling very sad and she gets kind of swept into this party and that's another bit that kind of does something to me, puts a lump in my throat when they say, and they all drank toasts to her beauty and then smashed the glasses so they'd never be raised to a lesser human.
Oh, my God.
And you can just see her little face and it's so
gorgeous. And we can't talk about Olive without talking about going back to the terrible Muriel.
Yeah.
And honestly... This reminds me of Daphne du Maurier in lots of ways, in that sense of like the sort of middle classy shyster upstart coming into the aristocracy. Yeah, why are you ruining our aristocracy? Yeah. And this woman comes in and we get the distinct sense that she has preyed on the new Earl Rupert while he's been recuperating in an hospital after. Some kind of war injury.
His plane's shot down, I think, or something.
Yeah. Misc war wound.
yes. Miscellaneous injury from the war.
Yeah. And she's a sort of well-moneyed, middle-class, kind of rising through society, a grasper. And she sort of traps him into a proposal and then sweeps into this sort of jolly, eccentric, aristocratic sort of house where everybody, like, there's, you know, servants who are sort of like throwing things across the throwing like objects at each other, like blunt objects. There's a kind of a pervert uncle that everyone loves.
Yeah,
there's all these characters.
That's an interesting...
all these outsized characters. And then Muriel comes in and she's like, first of all, she's very interested in eugenics.
Yes, I mean, quite the red flag.
Yeah.
Instantly.
I wonder, in your work around this historical time, and I think you're writing the foreword for a new edition of this, is that it?
No, they are re-releasing, because Ella is writing a foreword for one of them. They're re-releasing them as for an adult market, which is something else that we would be maybe interesting to talk about, because she wrote them as adult novels, but they've been published as young adult novels, which I think is right. I think they are amazing young adult novels. And I think the reason for that is because when she was writing them, there wasn't really such a thing as young adult fiction.
Yeah.
And she didn't know that she was writing amazing young adult fiction, but she was.
Yeah.
But they're being published again with new forwards by brilliant writers. Oh. Because she's such a writer's writer. That's another thing that I think is really interesting about her, is that when you find someone else who's read her work, she's a person that writers get so enthusiastic about. Really, we really love her. We really care about her a lot. So
Muriel, she's got this, it's what's really fascinating and prickly and like really horrifying about this woman, who is much worse than any du Maurier villain, is that she has a legitimate, very beautiful, very blonde, very Aryan, and this is, you know, the 20s, they're the late teens. And this is the beginnings of sort of a fascist ideology beginning thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we first meet her and she's going to all these lectures by the self-titled Dr. Lightbody. Lightbody.
The worst man in the world. And we definitely should talk about him and his wife, because he's the worst.
And they're just at first, at these lectures that seem, I mean, with the benefit of hindsight and history, we're all like, oh, this is what led to Nazism. But she's sitting there and she's like, well, yes, we breed animals, so they should be stronger and meatier and whatever. And of course we should breed humans, a leap. We should, like, yeah, people should be together based on having very strong children. That, after all, is the point of marriage and family, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And she just keeps making these jumps, and then she's... And it's written in this way where she's obviously a villain, but you understand the lineage of her thoughts and why they go there.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. And because I think something that she does that's really interesting is she has Anna make a point about the chickens, that so that she's, Anna says later on, she wouldn't marry her cousin.
Yeah.
And part of the reason that she wouldn't marry her cousin is because she knows that it's bad for you, it's bad for your children if you marry so closely into your family. And so it's almost like she gets this point of, which is kind of Muriel's starting point, mm-hmm. right? She starts by talking about in that kind of small way and then makes these jumps. And I think it's one of the things that makes this book, reading it now, so timely, is because there's this sense that Muriel is this insidious voice mm-hmm. of this kind of eugenic propaganda, that she's saying, but I'm not being cruel, I'm being practical.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is how we need to look at it. And so much of the, so many of the awful things that she does in the book, she's such a good villain because she does them in such a way that, like when she essentially cuts off ties with the Jewish family.
Yeah, the Rabinovitches.
Yeah, who are these kind of beloved people who are friends with everyone. And she does it in this kind of, I'm sure it would make you uncomfortable to come to a Christian ceremony. So she does it in this very honeyed way that presents itself as being for the good of everyone else, but that's actually this really awful way of pushing a terrible agenda.
It's such a heartbreaking scene as well, because you've got this family who are wonderful, and everyone who already lives in this area is wonderful. And they sort of, they're Polish Jews who sort of made a killing in the garment industry, and now they're living in the lap of luxury, and they're very generous with it, and they're just talking about, oh, we sent over a dinner service, and oh, is that the thank you note in the post?
Yes.
And then Mrs. Rabinovitch is just standing there with this note in her hand, and we don't get to see what the note says, but it's this like horrible moment where she's like, and it was the thing that had followed her whole life and would follow her forever.
Yeah, like it's the dark black thing that they're constantly afraid of, and that they're worried is going to kind of raise its head. And I think it's even more moving because this family have been introduced in such a way that it talks about how when they moved to the area, they assumed that they would be met with anti-Semitism, and then they weren't, and they were kind of embraced by the community and made these incredible friends and became so well loved. And so it's almost it kicks that bit harder because it's like they've relaxed. They thought they go in ready to be treated.
And then here
way.
Are their dearest friends introducing this anti-Semite
Absolutely.
To them, who is now going to be the new mistress of the house.
Yeah, and that's the end of it. That changes everything because that's the end of their, that as far as they understand in that moment, that's the end of their friendship with all these other people, because by cutting off that one person, they cut off everyone else.
Yeah, and that's how Muriel operates, as you said, in this like very honeyed way. Like there's she the only time in her eyes that she's ever done wrong is the moment she meets Ollie, and she's already agreed, and everyone already loves Muriel because she said, oh, you're a friend of the family, you're that, she can be my flower girl, she's 9 years old or whatever. Yeah. And then nobody has mentioned that she's got crutches, I think.
She's got one leg shorter than the other because she had polio, right?
Yes, that's it. And then Muriel just sort of like completely her hard drive just gets wiped in the moment. She's so horrified by this disabled child that she just says, why did nobody say she was a cripple?
Yeah.
And what's it, and how it's handled. And obviously, everyone, it's a horrible thing to say, but like how it's handled is like very like, they're so aware that this preteen girl, who's so beloved by everyone, Ollie, that she's in this point in her life where someone could say the wrong thing and it could ruin her life forever. It could be internalized and metabolized and would come out, and they're just so afraid of that happening.
Yeah, yeah. And I and one of the things that I really love is how righteously angry everyone's allowed to get. And I think that's one of the things that I really that really stops. You know, you were talking about how there's this kind of danger with Olive's character of her tipping into being kind of overly sentimental. And I think that's true of many of the characters in the book.
Yes.
But that it never quite happens because there's always this something sharp at the back of it.
Yeah.
And everyone's allowed to get really angry. And one of the things that I absolutely love is that the way that the kind of story with Olive resolves itself by...
Yes, tell us about that.
Yeah, so it's so great how... So in the end, Muriel kind of... They think they've sort of swept past this a bit, and Olive's obviously been upset, but is still planning to be the bridesmaid. But then at the end of the novel, Muriel goes and has a kind word with her and
about how the long ceremony would be hard on her legs.
Yes, exactly. And that's the moment that Olive is broken, and she won't come to the wedding. She can't. She stays in bed with her, you know, and this really heartbreaking with her face to the wall. She can't talk to anyone. She says something like she turns. Someone comes to brush her hair and she turns them away because she says cripples don't need to have nice hair.
Yeah, we don't need to be seen.
Yeah,
kind of thing.
And it is exactly that moment of that woman has broken her. That is the moment in her life where something terrible has happened that's going to stay with her. And then, I mean, this is what I was saying about there's being so many amazing characters. There's also out of nowhere, there's also this amazing character who's like Anna's old nursemaid from Russia, who wears like a saint's finger around her neck, and she's a really funny character.
She's the real Deus Machina of the book, isn't she?
Absolutely. But she turns up and kind of shutters herself away with Olive, and after they've had this talk, Olive is fine, and all that anyone can hear is this kind of strange Russian chanting behind the door. And then after the fact, Olive's stepmother finds like what's obviously a sort of wax voodoo doll of Muriel pins stuck in
her. So satisfying.
And it's so satisfying, and it's exactly that sort of thing that stops Olive from tipping over into becoming the sort of Dickensian, you know, sentimental figure. She has this sharpness, and the book celebrates it. The book doesn't say, you know, but ultimately it was wrong for her to, you know, to do that.
Yeah,
she
should have
been the
person.
Yeah. It's like, yes, good, we hate her, good for her.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
What's so interesting, there's a kind of a double-sided snobbery thing happening throughout this book, whereby the characters we love, the heroes that we love, and this family that live in the country and their friends, who are all fabulous and all under the tyranny of Muriel. Mm. They are fantastic, they're diverse, they're interesting, they love each other, there's an equality of sorts there. But there's also this sense in the book that anybody who steps outside of the, well, I'm the master of the house, and therefore in this patriarchal role whereby I know what's best for the servants, I respect them, but they are my lessers kind of thing. There's a very prickly politics happening there.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think it is, there's a very careful thing that happens, which is, I think she gets around that partly by sending Anna in, sort of like undercover boss style, to work with alongside these people. So she becomes sort of, at some points, she's sort of on a level with them. But also the book starts from the position that Rupert loves all the servants and he wants to look after
them.
And
they love him.
And they love him, but they are also his servants. And part of the reason that he and Anna make sense as a couple is because he sees those characters as individuals and he cares about, and when he turns up to the house, he's been away at war, his older brother who was supposed to inherit has died. And when he turns back up at the house, the staff all line up on the stairs to greet him. And it's a really nice scene because it's the first scene where he meets Anna, but also because it makes such a point about how he stops. He hasn't seen them for like 4 years or whatever. And he stops and asks specific questions and remembers stuff about everyone. And then when Muriel comes in, that's part of the tension of that, is her money is supposed to help him provide a home for these
people.
That's
the thing. So he's terrified because they're broke. They're your standard sort of land rich, cash poor aristocrats, the war has absolutely ravaged them, and they need to sell, really, but they don't want to fall out of the family, and they don't want all these people to become unemployed because they're a family themselves.
Yeah.
These dozen servants have been together basically their whole lives.
Yeah.
And they love each other, and it's splitting up that family. And so he's basically throwing himself on the altar of the rich Muriel so he can save these people.
Yeah, and Muriel has a big problem with the relationship between them and the servants, right? She says on several occasions, I don't understand why you're so familiar with them. This isn't really how they should be treated. And it's interesting, like you say, there's a lot of complicated things happening because Muriel doesn't come from the same aristocratic background, but she's the one who wants the lines unblurred. Yeah, exactly.
And it's that thing of, obviously, she's despicable, and it's so much fun to hate, and everything she does is inexcusable, but there is this sense of I have this slight pity for her, because it's almost like she's a person who doesn't know how to have servants but has seen a lot of films about it. And she comes in and she's like, oh yes, Anna, do this over there. And Anna's like, this isn't how you treat servants. I've had servants since I was born and this isn't how you treat them.
Yeah, but that's exactly one of the tensions, isn't it? Is that Anna, who from the beginning of the book, has grown up in absurd circumstances as a countess, who's the absolute pinnacle of everything that Muriel would want to be. She acts in a way that's completely at odds with the way that Muriel acts, that's how it is in the book, is that that's the true countess, the true quality of the countess coming through, is this kind of benevolent spirit.
It's very A Little Princess, isn't it?
Yeah.
All girls are princesses.
Yeah, yes, definitely, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, to go back to Dr. Lightbody and his wife, for me, they were the most, like, proper Wodehouse, Mitfordy, Evelyn Waugh, properly funny.
Yeah.
Like, absolutely farcical.
Yeah, it's the most awful thing, and it's so funny.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so funny. This is a bit worse. So he's got this, he's obviously this doctor of eugenics, and he's preaching his, like, oh, we should all marry strong Scandinavians for some reason. And then he goes home to his wife, who seems like a lovely woman, a just beleaguered angel who's always sewing his pants and making him cakes.
Yeah.
And she's like, she low-key has TV for the whole novel.
And he's so annoyed by her. Oh, she's always coughing. Ah. Oh.
It's like something from a radio play. It's yeah. hilarious. Yeah. And then she suddenly dies, or she gets sent, she's rushed to hospital, dies very quickly of TB. And the doctor's actually like, yeah, she was in the middle of cooking a chop, a pork chop, and then she fainted, and then someone, a neighbor came in and got her. And he was like, oh, was like, and Dr. Lightbody couldn't help but wonder what had happened to the chop.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's from a different thing, isn't it? It's yeah. like a whole different
yeah,
strand.
Yeah, yeah. He's I just love that. I think you're right. It's so funny. And then also it's so it's so cruel. And the reason it's funny is because he's so completely oblivious. He's just yeah. completely oblivious to how any human being would behave in this sort of situation. And it mentions how they got married in the first place because he got her pregnant, right?
Yeah,
and
yeah,
then,
yeah.
And then he's like, ugh. And then 2 months later she had a miscarriage, so what a waste of time that was. It's just like, oh no, it was awful.
He's such yeah. a simpering...
Yeah. 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 Yeah, and I think it's also interesting how he's so funny, because also that scene where he is eyeing up the eagle in the pet shop.
Oh my god, tell us the whole, okay, so he meets Muriel in Harrods, I think. Yeah.
Well, it's like fake Harrods, I think,
yeah.
right?
It's definitely Harrods.
Okay, yeah.
Tell us about the eagle.
Well, she's kind of upset because they've introduced a pet section, which... for some reason offends her slightly, and then she goes into this section because she sees Dr. Lightbody there, and it's written in such a way that it doesn't at first tell you what he's looking at, but it describes how kind of he's staring at this thing with such longing and such, you know, admiration.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so grotesque because it's this golden eagle, he's like yeah. chained to a post or
yeah,
something.
Yeah.
And he starts talking to Muriel about how he's imagining, not for himself, it's not for him, but for everyone else to see him with this eagle perched
would
on
help
him.
The cause.
Yeah, would
greatly.
Help the cause. Because he can picture how magnificent it would look, and he's not really interested in the way it looks, but for other people, it would be so helpful.
So funny.
And then there's this great line where it doesn't tell you what she says, but it says something about how she agrees with him, but then she sort of gently points out some of the practical difficulty
of chaining an eagle to yourself,
yeah,
in a lecture
absolutely.
Hall.
I think he has this image of it like swooping down and landing on his shoulder, and obviously she, and because this is part of her character, she's very practical, she's like the perfect woman for him because she wants to support him and manage
yeah.
him, basically. But yeah, so there are these scenes with him where he's absolutely grotesque.
He's low-key my favourite character.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's this bit as well where he like, like they're getting married on the Saturday, his wife dies on the Thursday. And he's like, oh shit, well I can't go to the wedding now. Oh, but I want to go to the wedding. Actually, less selfish. If I don't tell anyone my wife died,
I
go anyway.
Suffer in silence. No, and he goes through the whole process of doing here, being like, maybe if I wore a tasteful black armband. And then he's like, oh, but then I wouldn't be able to wear my super cool Greek god costume that I've bought for the fancy dress party. That wouldn't really go. Much better if I pretend it hasn't happened and save everyone.
And just not upset Muriel, you know? She's yeah. a nice gal. She's been through a lot.
Yeah. Not for me, you understand. Not for myself.
And what's so good about it as well, I think it's, you know, it draws a straight line to where we are with our current neo-fascism in politics.
Yeah.
Is that, like, fascism and eugenics and finding intellectual ways to make white people feel good about themselves
absolutely.
Has always been for losers.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. Yes, exactly that. And I think what's really interesting about the book is that they don't end up in, like, necessarily an unhappy way, because it's okay to talk about the end, right?
Yes, of course, we do all spoilers, yeah.
But they... yeah, he and Muriel, you know, which we need to talk about, gets scared off from the wedding.
And
he and Muriel depart for America together. His wife's conveniently dead now. So there's this kind of gleam of appreciation in Muriel's eye when she finds that out, that they're going to go to America. And it's not a terrible ending for them. But, you know, it's like you were saying earlier about the way it, you know that this is the beginning of this kind of fascist use of eugenics. You know they're going to be Nazis, and you know it's going to end badly for them. And that in itself is quite satisfying.
That's true. I was going to say they never get their comeuppance. But I suppose in history they do.
Yeah, I feel like for the reader, you know, you have that moment of they've left, and for me, I like to think, you know, that's Olive's pins doing its work, you know. It's not gonna end well for them.
That's true. Yeah, they're gonna go to Berlin and like be on the outer rungs. They're not even gonna get close to Hitler.
No, he's not gonna bother with them.
Yeah,
because that's the other thing about Dr. Lightbody. He's this kind of golden self-appointed expert in this stuff, but he's so obviously rubbish. He's so obviously terrible and useless, and so yeah, he absolutely doesn't have the pair of them don't have what it takes to even become good Nazis. So you know,
I have faith Muriel could be a good Nazi.
Yeah, that's true.
In as such as that can exist. So we gotta talk about the ending, because honestly, I love this book. Read it in a day on holidays. Fantastic. Just on the beach. Lovely. Yeah, and it's
ideal.
Nice and lightweight as well, so you don't get a tired wrist.
But
the ending is bizarre.
Yes.
So here's the deal.
When you try and describe this ending, you're going to sound like a mad woman.
Let me just stop the podcast here, everyone. So the deal is that Rupert, who I have problems with, our romantic lead, is morally opposed to the idea of jilting a woman. Okay. So he wants, they want Muriel to leave Rupert, so Rupert won't jilt Muriel. But Muriel will only do that, she wants to be a countess so badly, she'll only do that if she believes there is a genetic reason to not marry Rupert. And so they pay some weird cousins
from Birmingham, obviously.
Who are also of Irish descent, it is pointed out several times, which is weird, who are described in the most vile way, in a way that I'm like, Eva, were you high when you wrote this? Are you having a bad trip?
What's the way that she talks about, she has the dad, is it Melvin, describe his sons at one point early on in the book as being just like lumps of flesh or something. Like they're just lumps of meat.
Just like they're like 12-year-old boys lolling on the mattress on the ground with half a sandwich in their mouth. It's like dystopian, this family. There's so many different threads in this book. The butler...
Prume. That's a good character.
He's great. Pays them to pretend to be deranged.
Yes.
And he puts them in like a tower.
Yes.
And they pretend to be chickens. And then they show this to Muriel and she goes, well, I can't marry you. And then she fucks off.
She's like, that's it then.
And that's the end of the book.
that's it.
What do you think, Laura?
Well, I feel like I really...
We've all been on deadline for a book.
I enjoy it for several reasons. And one of them is I really like, it feels like, because she's this amazing children's writer as well, that to me feels like that's straight out of a children's book. And I like how she brings some of these kind of slightly more madcap ideas and characters into her older writing. But I also think it works because it's Prume who puts the idea together. That's the key to me, is because the butler, who is so straight-laced, who is the most, the absolute stereotype of what you imagine a great butler to be.
Yeah, very remains of the day.
Yes, exactly. And very practical, very sensible, doesn't like a lot of fuss, comes up with what has to be the most ludicrous, dramatic, insane.
And everyone is like, this won't work.
Everyone is like, there are a lot of moving parts involved in this very elaborate plan. Like, there must be a simpler way.
If you're going to plan a wedding day jilting, make it simple, you know?
Yeah. But then I love also they have... the way it's enacted is very Jane Eyre, and they have this reference to Jane Eyre in there, yes. where Dr. Lightbody's kind of compelled to, does anyone object? And he gets up and it's, there are mad people in the tower!
Oh,
and they all get dragged out of the wedding to go and see them.
And it's this brilliant throwaway line that's like, and the parson who had read Jane Eyre 4 times.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And how everyone's really bemused. And then also how there's this great line about Rupert's mother who doesn't know about the plan. And so there's kind of Rupert's looking over at her and she's looking really puzzled. And then as the kind of tale unfolds, the very last thing in that chapter before they go off to see the thing is she gets to her feet and very dramatically is like, the truth is out now, Rupert. There's no use trying to hide from this any longer. And he's so baffled.
Oh my
and
God.
I find the humour in that so well handled.
It's so farcical, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah,
it really does
have that really farcical quality that I enjoy. But it is absolutely bonkers. It's completely mad.
Mental. And I don't mind.
Know? No, I enjoy it.
I just love it. The one thing we haven't really talked about, because... unfortunately, it's kind of one of the lesser compelling parts of the book, is the romance.
Mm.
So Anna and Rupert, they have a lot of very sexually charged scenes.
Yeah, I'm actually quite into the romance in this book, but you said you have, like, you're not so keen on Rupert, or you have issues with him.
He doesn't really do a lot.
Mm.
He kind of first comes upon... Anna she's having a bath in the lake, and it's very like, oh, this is straight out of a romance novel, and I love it.
Yeah,
and, like, her
I'm
hair
super
is screen covering
yes.
all of her bits
yeah.
and stuff, and he kind of has this weird thing with her hair, and I don't really see their click. Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
It's not brimming with charisma for me.
I feel like I really enjoy. One of the things that I really like about their romance is that instead of it being one of these things where they're both kind of denying their feelings, I feel like it, and then at the end they kind of realise that they're in love with each other. What I enjoy about it is that there's a sense that, for me, I felt like there's an immediate kinship between them.
Mm.
They recognise something in each other immediately. And the conversations that they have are slightly like wandering, but it's like that lovely thing
she was
of
very
being
slow
able to
burning.
Follow
yeah.
each other's train of thought. And then relatively early on in the book, they both kind of admit to themselves that they're in love with each other. So and the way that that's written, I think, is so nice. Like, there's really... one moment that I think really stood out for me when I was reading it this time was when they're just in the garden and they're having a chat, and she's looking at the roses and she's sort of talking to him, and there's this moment where they're not talking about anything super emotional, and there's this moment where she writes in parentheses his aside, which is something like, and what would you say if I cut all these roses off and lay them in your lap?
Mm.
And it's like, at that point there's been no explicit idea that they're in love with each other. They haven't kind of had much physical interaction, but there's a sense that I like that there's this really deliberate, and it's marked out on the page as this deliberate aside where you get this moment of kind of panic in him. And that's what it comes out as quite often, right? When he touches her hair, he has this, like, moment of panic, and he's like, well, I guess that's my one moment of...
Yeah.
So I really buy into it.
No, I think what it is, I do believe in the love. I just think maybe I'm just... jilting someone isn't that bad, and he just lets it go too far.
Yeah, but that's like, this is why, so I was talking to her, Eva Ibbotson's grandson, about her, and he said... she was a huge Georgette Heyer fan, like, had like shelves of Georgette Heyer. And it, once he said it, that's exactly what I was like, of course she was.
Yeah.
And I think you see that's
propriety.
That's it, yeah, isn't it? There's like a Regency vibe of it's impossible for me to be
break
the,
my word.
The jilty word, yeah. The jilter. And it's difficult. But then I think she kind of saves that a little at the end by having that moment where in the wedding ceremony he decides he's not going to marry her, right? But it's before he can say no that suddenly the thing is sprung on
yes,
him.
Yes, you are right.
Because he says he told Olive that if she wasn't the bridesmaid, there would be no wedding. And then there's this whole moment where the ceremony started and Olive's not turned up. And he's like, well, that's the promise. You know, that's another promise that I made.
One promise cancels another one.
Yeah. And he kind of knows that he can't do it. So there is, I think that's an important moment in the story because I think if it had been like you knew he was just going to go through with it and marry her,
yeah,
and then it was only Prue's scheme that saved him, it wouldn't be as satisfying.
You're right. Yeah. There's like one thing that's so beautiful about the writing, and I don't really read out that much on this podcast, but now I'm going to do it twice. I don't really like reading out loud, which is bad for selling books. But there's this part where they have this costume party and she is... It's kind of the centerpiece of the book,
yeah,
really, and they've invited all the Russian ballerinas who all reckon on her brothers,
her friends,
there, her friends, like her dear friends, the Russian ballet.
Yeah.
And there's a bit where she has to pretend that she isn't a maid, that she's just there in costume,
yes,
as a maid, which is,
yes,
just perfect, and
yes,
lovely. And she dances with him, and they're at that point they're so aware of how in love with each other they are, and she's already confessed her feelings to him in Russian,
yeah,
and he'll never know what she said,
yeah,
but you know, whatever, he knew what she means. And they're waltzing, and oh, I just loved this so much. It's so sentimental, and it's such garbage,
yes,
but it's
yes,
so beautiful. Okay, I'm gonna read it. To this waltz, born in a distant snowbound country, out of longing for just a flower-scented summer night as this, Rupert and Anna danced. They were under no illusions. The glittering chandeliers, the gold mirrors with their drapes of acanthus leaves, the pungent violins. It might be the stuff of romance, but this was no romance. It was a moment in a lifeboat before it sank beneath the waves. A walk across the sunlit courtyard towards the firing squad. This waltz was all they had. And I, reader, cried when I read that. Because this is a book where people do get killed by firing,
yeah,
squads.
Absolutely.
That is not a phrase she just put in,
yeah,
there lightly. Her father was probably,
yes,
executed that way.
Yes, yes. And I think they're kind of... they're both characters who have known this tremendous amount of loss and been in these really terrible situations.
And they're ready to metabolize
ready
another
to,
one.
Yeah, and
yeah,
they just... and they're ready for that to be their lives again. And there's this kind of golden sunlit moment. And it's so well done, the way that everyone around them can see the love coming off them. And it's another one of those scenes where they don't... she makes such a point of saying, you know, they don't talk while they're dancing. They,
yeah,
just kind of stare at each other. And it's this high, high, high romance. But that scene, maybe more than any of the others, is one of the ones that I think is really like that fairy tale quality of the story. That it gives you that really comforting, familiar, sentimental romance,
yeah,
that you can just kind of relax and into.
This is a perfect of where, you know, how highbrow my cultural tastes are, in that I just thought of the film Anastasia.
Yes, I've said this before, that the closest thing that we have to an Eva Ibbotson adaptation
is
Anastasia.
The Fox animation.
Yeah, absolutely, because it is really such a similar vibe.
The more I think about it, the more it is. And
yes,
the same sense of this, like, terrible things happened and happen every day, but like there is this joy and this merriness kind of to it that is so... I mean, and people talk about like Disney being like, oh, the stories are so dark. It's like the Anastasia movie starts with the pretext of, so a girl's entire family is murdered.
Slaughtered.
Yeah. And like it deals with like PTSD in like,
yeah,
really interesting ways.
Yeah.
And it's just such a good... But yeah, but that there is a kind of a bit where they sort of have their last dance before he has, and it's the kind of thing of like, well, we're from two different worlds and it will never work out. And
and in this book, I think it's so nice because you get those moments of shadow in there as well. There's and it comes through from the different characters. So you have Muriel in there who's kind of getting stuck in making everyone's lives miserable, but there's a lot of other stuff happening too. Like, they do talk about the people that they've lost. There's that scene between Rupert and his best friend Tom where they both talk about how their brothers have died and they have survivor's guilt. And in this book that's so light and delicate and airy and comfortable, it still has this kind of shade and shadow in it that I think makes it work so beautifully. And so in that moment when you're reading it, you're absolutely there with them. You absolutely know this is just one fleeting moment, even though one of the things that is incredible for me about Eve Ibbotson as a writer is that she's such a safe pair of hands, and you know it's kind of going to be okay.
That is nice. Yeah. You know, from like page one,
it's going to be okay.
Any bad thing, it won't be bad for too long.
Yeah, and she said that. That's something that she said, that she can't, that she didn't like to have her character suffer, that she couldn't keep it up for very long.
She's like a Nancy Mitford who's a nice person.
Well, she described these her romance novels, these were the ones that she was the proudest of, and she said she described them as books that she wrote for women in their sick beds. And I just think that's perfect, isn't it?
It is such sick bed books.
Yeah, they are. They're such a comforting thing. They just make you feel so much better. When I finished reading one of her books, when I finished reading this book today, I just felt, one of the reasons that I was crying was because, this is going to sound so ridiculous, but was because I felt so kind of well looked after.
Yes.
But it was that feeling of like when someone loves me. Like, someone's just taken such good care of me that I don't know what to do with myself.
Your eyes are like shiny. Yeah, exactly. There's been a lot of shiny moments in it that we just met, so it's quite awkward.
Yeah, exactly that. Exactly that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I feel very shiny now. It's a beautiful place to leave it. What is the next Eve Ibbotson book I should read after this?
There aren't really any bad choices. My favourite after this is maybe A Company of Swans, which is the first Eve Ibbotson that I read. So it has a special place in my heart, which is set in Manaus in the rainforest and has ballerinas in. Get excited.
Love it. All right, and you obviously have written many books. Tell us about your new one that I'm looking at right now. It's a beautiful jade cover with a golden emboss. This could be an Eve Ibbotson cover, honestly.
Yeah, they Scholastic look after me so well with my covers. The cover for this is the artist Yeren Tong, and the designer is Jamie.
Tell
Gregory.
Us the name of the book.
Yeah. Oh yeah, sorry. The book is much less important than the beautiful cover. The book is called Andro Dancing Star, and it's a Much Ado About Nothing prequel set in 1930s Italy.
Lovely.
Obviously.
So we've got all the Ibbotsons, we've got interwar, we've got mainland Europe.
Yep. There's so
a
much.
Girl.
It was so funny when I was rereading this today, and I was like, oh wow. She's a huge, huge influence on my young adult writing, definitely. And there's lots of Ibbotson in this one. But yeah, it's a really fun book. It was really fun to write.
This has been Sentimental Garbage, and I've been Caroline O'Donoghue. You can follow me on Twitter at Zaroline, that's Czaroline, or email me by the podcast at ZaroLineO'Donoghue@gmail.com. This has been a Justice for Dumb Women podcast. Thanks to Harry Harris for the jingle, Gavin Day for the logo, and Acast for the recording space.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.